there has been a growing narrative post FTX that, you know, people think that under collateralized lending or capital efficient lending is not going to be a thing. DeFi actually outperformed CeFi precisely because DeFi is mostly over collateralized, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, under collateralized lending will happen.
Yep.
It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And I've personally underestimated how hard it is to build under-collateralized lending. So it's taking longer than I originally expected, but it will happen. It's not a good idea to hate on under-collateralized lending. What really happened with the likes of Genesis, by the way, is under-collateralized lending, for example. What really happened to under-collateralized lending, whether it's in DeFi or CeFi, is the mispricing of risks. It's not the fact that it's under-collateralized. It's because the risks are mispriced. The rates were too low to compensate for the risks that the lenders were taking. And the risks will be taken care of by the market. The market will always take care of itself in terms of rates, risks.
Yeah.
So we're just going to see higher yields, higher rates, but that does not prevent under-collateralized lending from happening.
Welcome to Good Game, a podcast for crypto insiders with your host, Imran and Chow. Welcome to Good Game episode 11. We'll be talking about DeFi. DeFi has been a sector that's been very close to me. That's how Alliance got started, primarily with DeFi Alliance. And, you know, it's probably one of the first sectors that actually took off. And it was noted in Vitalik's early research of how open finance or DeFi was one area of what was going to allow Ethereum to really take advantage of all the products that are going to be built. Before we get started, Chow, I know you had a couple thoughts. So I'd love to hear what you're thinking here.
Yeah, I mean, we can start with the high level. I feel like over the past year or so, you and I listened to a bunch of pitches in DeFi. I feel like it's been mostly uninspiring. Most of the innovations we've seen has been incremental mechanistic innovations. So like little changes on the AMM algorithm, little changes on the liquidation engines and stuff like that. It's been mostly boring, but this episode, when I prepared for this episode, I digged into a bunch of data and I found a lot of interesting things, a lot of interesting data, mm-hmm. as well as protocol designs. So I'm actually very excited to talk about DeFi for this episode. But in terms of high level, I think it's very clear that if you look across many data sets, across different layer ones or across different DeFi protocols, that DeFi volume has been going down this year, almost monotonically. And it's not really surprising because, you know, we've learned this in DeFi summer, right? When prices go up, all the metrics go up. And when prices go down, all the metrics go down. And fundamentally, there's two pathways that are causing this. So the one is, for example, when prices go down, TVL, by definition, goes down. Because a lot of the assets that are deposited in the various pools are not stable coins, they're crypto assets, like they're ETH or, you know, BTC or whatever, right? So when prices go down, the dollar amount of the TVL that are deposited into these pools go down by definition. So that's the first mm-hmm. pathway. And the second pathway is just that when prices go down, you know, retail traders lose interest, there's lower speculation, and that leads to lower trading volume on DEXs, lower lending volume, lower, you know, well, actually the only thing that stabilizes or might even go up is stablecoins because people now liquidate their assets into stablecoins. But overall, the result of these two pathways is that any metrics that you look at, whether it's trading volume or TVL or open interest, everything goes down in the bear market.
You highlighted something which earlier, which talked about like very... in terms of innovation, there's lackluster of innovation, and if anything, it's mostly incremental. I think I agree with that. This might sound a bit bold, but I feel like 80% of DeFi has already been built out in terms of what customers are looking for in terms of product. And we're similar to the kind of the iPhone moment when the iPhone came out and people were looking to Tim Cook to find newer upgrades that would really blow their competitors out of the water. But instead, they got a couple minor upgrades that kind of improved the UI UX or the onboarding of customers to the company. And so I think similarly, we're going through the same kind of pathway in regards to really just improving like capital efficiency, security, and finding products that actually find users in a way that's going to help them expand markets in different sectors type of thing. So I feel like that's kind of where we are in DeFi. And with that, what we're going to do is talk a bit about some of the interesting upgrades that are coming out with some of our blue chip protocols like Aave, Uniswap, Compound, Synthetics, Curve, and then dive deeper into some of the sectors and understand more or less where is the innovation, where is the alpha, and from there dive deep into whether or not a product like this is needed in the space. So high level, like, you know, state of the market, FTX obviously happened a few months ago, and people now realize, most people, and what I mean by most people, talking about the real world, not the crypto world, realize that DeFi is a thing and it should be used versus centralized organizations. So there's a lot of great tailwinds coming for DeFi today. There are some issues. I think some of the issues that we have, and we've talked about this in the last few episodes, is the inability for end users to interact with DeFi seamlessly. It's still a very convoluted experience. When I talk to, let's say, someone that's outside of DeFi, and I ask them about like borrow lend, their mind just blows up because the only thing they understand is just mortgage. And outside of that, they never even take out a loan for anything else, right? Maybe school, but that's about it. So these products have to become much more consumer oriented in order for us to hit mass market. And the onboarding has to be so easy that private key management is done in such a way that you don't have to, you can mitigate any of those attack vectors that are available today from phishing scams and et cetera. And then finally, it's like kind of regulations, as we all know. Like people don't know where to, like founders don't know where to build. Users don't know where they should go because they don't understand the landscape well. An example of this is like Gemini Earn and other earning products ended up, I think most imploded. Most of the products in that sector imploded, primarily because the yield was coming from the same place. where the yield was coming from had very bad, like, you know, risk management practices, which ended up like destroying that entire
stuff. So when you say yield all comes from the same place, do you mean Genesis or?
Yeah. Okay. For the most part. Yeah. And so I think that's where we are. I would say that's kind of where we are in terms of the state of DeFi.
And by the way, just to play devil's advocate on the first one you brought up, which is that the collapse of FTX should, in theory, be a tailwind for DeFi.
Yep.
So I actually tried to find data points supporting that over the last couple of days, and I couldn't find any. So after FTX, DeFi volume has not obviously gone up. There's no evidence, no strong evidence suggesting that DeFi has gone up since FTX. I think what happened was that people withdrew money from everywhere, obviously mostly from centralized exchanges, but they are not putting that money back to work into DeFi yet. Everyone just scared right now.
Yeah, I feel like everyone's scared.
So I think this tailwind, the collapse of FTX has towards DeFi, will take a while to play out. So that's just sort of a minor counter argument.
Yeah, I do think, I agreed with you. I think it's going to take some time before DeFi and just crypto starts to get taken advantage of again. Right now, I think everyone is burned from the entire rendezvous of pulling out of DeFi protocols, then having to pull out of banks, then having to pull out of regulated banks, exchanges. So I feel like the market is healing. And over time, the hope is that DeFi will start to take off compared to exchanges. In fact, it was funny. I was just talking to a couple market makers over the past couple of weeks, and they're absolutely certain that DEXs are going to be like, they're going to overtake exchanges generally, and that's going to be a thing like for the next like cycle. And so I thought that was an interesting data point where they're more bullish on DEXs.
I mean, market makers were the ones that are heard the most throughout this FTX drama because market makers, they have to have money on exchanges in order to make markets. And that is in contrast to long-term investors where they can put their assets into a much more secure third-party custodian. So market makers have been disproportionately hurt by FTX. And that's why they obviously want DeFi to succeed.
Yep. And maybe on that note, we could talk about the first blue chip, which is Uniswap. Obviously, everyone knows what Uniswap is. It's an AMM for crypto assets. They use a pooled model as a way for liquidity to be provided on these assets. And then those that want to trade assets can just jump on Uniswap to purchase an asset very seamlessly without having to, all with just a wallet. Now, Uniswap has grown in size. Uniswap has billions in TVL. They're probably 90% market share, maybe 85% market share of the entire
DEX. I'm sharing the data right here.
Yeah, so, share the data, please.
So obviously, when we talk about market share, we need to define what the market is, right? So yeah. In this chart, which is pulled from Messari, the market is the total volume traded on spot exchanges, okay? Spot decentralized exchanges. So basically, that excludes derivative exchanges as well as centralized exchanges. Okay, so that's the denominator. The denominator is the spot decentralized exchanges. And among those exchanges, Uniswap has a 63% market share as of November last year. Obviously, things will change over time, but this will give you an idea of how dominant Uniswap has been among the decentralized spot exchanges.
So yeah, and that's with the 7-day rolling average, which is like very interesting in regards to how Uniswap has performed relative to other AMMs. Now, with the V2 was a very simple model, right, of being able to provide liquidity. They have their own pricing function that helps provide the price for the assets. Then they moved into a different model for V3, which was liquidity concentration model, where you provide liquidity based on different price bands. And that would allow better pricing, lower slippage, and the ability for market makers or LPs to make money and better to provide like ways of leverage in terms of the types of prices that they want to quote. It turns out like average LPs couldn't participate because they were getting destroyed by the changes of volatility. And it turns out Uniswap V2, which was more retail-oriented AMM, has now turned into more of a professional AMM that allows certain market makers and professional traders to be able to provide liquidity. And so that's the state of Uniswap V3 today. There are a lot of things that are in play for Uniswap. An example of this is there's this constant debate about fee switches that you may have heard about that the community is going back and forth on, but it seems like Uniswap is not taking any approach of whether or not they want to turn that back on. And it turns out governance itself has been kind of lacking in regards to how to.
Doesn't that also, like turning the fees on, doesn't that also have a lot of securities law implications? Because if you start to redistribute the revenues back to the token holders, then you're basically saying that you're a security. So I'm that's sure right. They don't want to take a risk like this.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. And so I think they're taking a different approach, which is, I think we chatted about a bit about this in our last episode, which is Uniswap wants to become more retail-oriented, and it seems to me more regulated, at least on the front-end side. And maybe not on the smart contract side, but on the front-end side. And they're doing this in kind of several ways. One is like they delisted any like assets that would violate the securities laws. You know, they delisted some of the synthetics assets like Microsoft stocks and et cetera. Mm-hmm. Two is they are making a push for mobile with their upcoming mobile wallet release. And number three is touching on retail, they acquired Genie, which we mentioned earlier, and they're going to start to offer, or they started offering NFT trading directly on this platform. Mm-hmm.
By the way, these three things that you just mentioned, I think it's very common across DeFi in general. Like these three trends happen everywhere else as well. So one is they start caring more about securities laws. Like that it's getting really serious this year. And the second was everyone is looking for a mobile strategy. And the third one is actually more about DeFi projects going horizontal. So they all start as, like, let's say Uniswap started as a DEX, right? And now they're going into a different vertical, which is the NFT marketplace. So this is something that I predicted. I actually tweeted about this a couple of years ago, which is that every DeFi project will start competing with each other at some point. Because like once you've dominated the AMM spot exchange space, you're going to have more goals. You're going to have more ambitions. You're going to go horizontal. So once again, a very common trend.
I feel like it's similar. Like if you look at the exchange market, right? You have Coinbase and let's say Binance. And if you look at all the products they offer everything.
That's right.
Right?
Yep.
So I feel like Uniswap will ultimately become one of those players in the space.
I want to add one thing about Uniswap V3, which we've talked about before, but I want to reiterate, which is that Uniswap V3 is very much more like an order book than a automated market maker. And this is something that I remember Evgeny from Wintermute pointed out the day that V3 came out, that V3 is more favorable to institutions, to professional market makers than to retail traders, because V3, the fact that it looks more like an order book, allows for more flexibility in how market makers can create their own algorithm. So order books are more quote unquote Turing complete than AMM. So it allows for more creativity, and creativity is better for professional traders than for retail. So I think the debate between AMM and order book is no longer a relevant debate, because even the best AMM is moving towards more of a order book model.
And just so the audience know, the Uniswap V2 model was used to use a pricing mechanism, or the formula X times Y equals K, to determine the price of the crypto asset, or what AMMs are called as constant product market maker model. So what Chao was saying is, like, order books are probably, it seems like DeFi is going the order book model no matter what, because it's just the best way to quote prices. So that's all of what's happening in Uniswap. And I think at the end of the day, Uniswap is probably going to become like a Coinbase or a Binance. Whereas if you look at Curve is very interesting, because they're taking a complete decentralized approach. Uniswap and Curve will probably, even though they seem like they're competitors today, over time, the target market of their customers are going to become very different. And they're going to become very different because Curve takes a very decentralized approach into their customers. They could list any asset if they wanted to. They don't care about securities laws. They're decentralized in nature. Even if you remember the token launch of Curve, it was some Anon, if you remember that tweet. We'll quote this in our show notes, but it was some llama that kickstarted, somehow got access to the Curve smart contracts and kicked off the Curve token when it went public. So no one really knows who, what, when that happened, how it happened, but it happened. Versus Uniswap, where Uniswap had like a certain date where they airdrop tokens. It was a celebrated event. There was a cool video that came out that celebrated the launch. Whereas we had an Anon dude that kicked off the token launch for Curve that no one knew who it was. So I think over time, there'll be just two different complete markets. And our thesis in the space is that there will probably be two worlds in the space, which is regulated and like completely decentralized world. So some stats on Curve, they average about $200 to $300 million in trading volume today. There's some really cool products that are coming out from Curve that makes it pretty unique in terms of how they're thinking about it. And then maybe what we could do is talk a bit about like it's Curve's ecosystem. Because of the VE tokenomics that's in play, there's this entire ecosystem of like protocols that are vying for control of Curve so that they could control the liquidity of Curve generally. And so like one of the products that are coming out, it's supposed to come out anytime now, and I think it's probably going to be launched the same way, is Curve USD. Curve in its entirety is an AMM, similar to Uniswap. The difference was, you know, Curve really started off as a stablecoin AMM and then moved over to just blue chip crypto assets. And now it's becoming more and more decentralized in terms of how it provides new liquidity for newer assets that are coming onto the platform. But Curve has an interesting model in terms of how it's planning to launch its Curve USD. And it's called Llama. And what this is ultimately, you could think of this as like a liquidation engine with an AMA kind of plugged into the liquidation engine. So the way you want to think about this is, if I want to mint Curve USD, I provide collateral. Let's say I provide $500 in ETH collateral. I will be able to mint, let's say, $100 worth of Curve USD as an example. And that collateral will stay on Curve's platform. And let's say ETH starts to go down in price. The AMM within Llama, which is a liquidation engine and AMM, will be able to automatically sell off your asset so they could continuously top up your collateral. So that way you won't experience, let's say, a liquidation on your collateral. And this is their like innovation in a way, where they provide seamless efforts for anyone to provide collateral. It increases the capital efficiency of Curve USD and more collateral on Curve. And then that trading volume should in fact impact Curve from a holistic perspective. So this is supposed to be like a flywheel effect that would allow Curve to continue to gain market share in terms of its AMM. So that's like the high level on Curve and Curve USD. Outside of that, it has $4 billion in TVL and is consistently doing $200 to $300 million in trading volume.
So here's an interesting data point related to Uniswap and both Uniswap and Curve and other DEXs.
Yeah.
So and circling back to the earlier discussion of FTX, how has that changed the landscape of DeFi versus CeFi? Well, right now, whatever metrics that you look at, whether it's, you know, trading volume or open interest or whatever, the top decentralized protocols are still one order of magnitude below the centralized below the top centralized exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I'm going to use the word order of magnitude a lot. And this goes back to our last episode about crypto data. The crypto data is just so fucking messy. It's unbelievable. Like if you look at five different data sources, you're going to get six different data points. So
yeah, we're just arguing about like DeFi Llama and Masari.
Exactly. Right? Like we're talking about how DeFi Llama and Masari provide different data. So
yep.
What I do is I triangulate between different data sources, and you never know the exact number for sure, because they either the data indexing is different between them, or the methodology of, you know, calculating volume, for example, is different between them. And as a result, their numbers are all different. But what I do is I triangulate between them, and I try to find a number that's... I can never have 100% conviction. I can only have conviction on whether or not this is at this order of magnitude or the next order of magnitude. And by order of magnitude, I mean a factor of 10. Mm-hmm. And that tells you how bad the data is. But anyway, so going back to DeFi versus CeFi, I think it seems to me that trading volume on top decentralized exchanges are still one order of magnitude below the top centralized exchanges.
Got it. Yeah, no, that's very helpful in regards to where DeFi generally fits in with centralized exchanges. It kind of also speaks to like the way that these AMMs are moving in direction as well. If you look at Curve with the launch of its own stablecoin, it's starting to compete with other decentralized stablecoins. So if you think about like Maker, if you want to call Maker decentralized, and others, an obvious upcoming stablecoin called Go, which we'll talk a bit more about. What do you think the play is here? Why stablecoins? I have a few thoughts, but I'm curious on your thoughts here.
I want to share another data set here. So this is the current sort of ranking of stablecoins, including both centralized, like dollar-backed stablecoins, as mm-hmm. well as quote-unquote decentralized stablecoins like DAI, Frax, and so on. And once again, in the world of stablecoins, the top decentralized stablecoins are one order of magnitude lower than the top centralized stablecoins, right? Like if you look at DAI, market cap is like 5 billion and Tether is like 60. But one good area where we made progress this year in DeFi is that as an industry, we finally realized that under-collateralized stablecoins will not work. And I tweeted this in 2018 when Basis and Maker came out. I described exactly how Basis was not going to work and why Maker was going to work. And it took the industry 4 years to realize this. And what it took was the collapse of Terra to realize this. So, but at least I think that's a positive development in DeFi, which is why currently the top decentralized stablecoin is still Maker. I think that's interesting. What are your thoughts on stablecoins?
I think it creates customer stickiness for obvious reasons, right? Like if you are the go-to AMM or exchange and the pairing assets of each of those crypto assets is your stablecoin and they're highly liquid and increases trading volume, then it creates stickiness and it helps the entire flywheel. I mean, Binance is a perfect example of this. Binance yeah. has now denominated all of its trading assets into trading pairs into BUSD. And even those that are not BUSD will auto-convert to BUSD to use its own stablecoin because it just it's cheaper, it generates more fees, and it creates more stickiness and loyalty and increases loyalty as well.
So if you look at this ranking again, BUSD yeah. is now number 3. That was one of the biggest surprises for me this year in the stablecoin world. And I mean, in hindsight, it's not that surprising because Binance has so much distribution, right? And
yep.
they basically, I think they delisted a bunch of USDT denominated or USDC denominated pairs.
USDT.
USDT, okay.
Yeah.
And really push for growing BUSD.
And I think there's a reason for that. And I think that is, you know, all of the things that I mentioned earlier, which is like, you know, it creates more stickiness for your platform, you know, generating fees. It helps you control the depths of the pools, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel like, you know, outside of Maker, there isn't really a decentralized stablecoin that's really targeting this market. If you look at currently at the market of all of the DAI that has been outstanding, about 5.8 billion of the DAI is right now sitting in EOAs. And that kind of shows you the demand the DAI has in the market today. That's how much money is sitting in smart contracts right now in DeFi.
Last week, I was on the Empire podcast. And and they asked me, like, what is something that has really found product market fit in crypto? The first thing that came to my mind was stablecoins. And this may not be something that people who live in the developed world can really appreciate. But if you walk in the street in anywhere in Latin America and you just grab a random person, there's a very good chance that they've interacted with USDT or USDC or DAI. Like double-digit percentage probability. And they use it, one, as an inflation hedge against their local currency, because US dollar, despite the fact that we experienced like 8% inflation last year, US dollar outperformed everything else, every other currency in the world. And two, they use stablecoins as a means of transfer, means of payment. So stablecoins, very important.
And similarly, like if you look at Aave, they're announcing their own stablecoin as well called Go. Aave has, I mean, there's two conflicting data points that we saw. Aave has 7 billion TVL on DeFi Llama and let's say 13 billion on Messari. So let's say average of 5 billion. And that's what I saw on Aave's website. So I'm going to go with that. So Aave is the leading lending protocol in crypto today. They were the first to launch on many layer twos and layer ones while everyone else was like, oh, you know, Ethereum only. They kind of like defied the audience and they went on, you know, they launched on layer ones and layer twos, including like Arbitrum, Optimism, Avalanche, et cetera. And now they've amassed, let's say, $5 billion in TVL. Aave launched V3 as well. And so like if you look at the data points here of what Chao is sharing, Aave has roughly 13.9 billion. MakerDAO has 9 billion. And so that kind of gives you the idea of where everything's at.
Again, I'm not 100% sure this is 100% accurate, but it should be accurate within an order of magnitude. It's very likely that Aave is the leading lending platform right now.
That's right. What are your thoughts on the current lending marketplace today?
Yeah. So there have been, at the beginning of this session, I said that most DeFi innovations have been minor incremental improvements on the algo side of things. But it turns out that in lending, I've seen the most interesting changes and most interesting disruptions out of all the verticals in DeFi. So there's two things. One is that fixed rate lending has really taken off. So fixed rate lending like Notional. The problem that it solves is basically the fact that in the early days, Aave, Compound, they're basically money markets, and therefore their rates basically fluctuate on a continuous basis. So lenders and borrowers, they don't have much certainty in terms of what rate they're going to be getting in the future. So fixed rate lending actually did really well, surprisingly, this year. And it's gotten within one order of magnitude from Aave in terms of TVL and lending volume. So fixed rate lending is very interesting. The other very interesting development is peer-to-peer lending. Okay. And the problem that solves is that in the case of Aave and Compound, they are originally peer-to-pool lending where the borrowers would borrow from a unified pool of assets and the lenders will deposit their money into a unified pool, into the same pool of assets. So you borrow and lend from this pool according to some mathematical formula. The problem with that is this mathematical formula creates a lot of market inefficiency. Okay, so the rates are not 100% completely driven by the market. They're driven by this formula that has very little degrees of freedom. And so peer-to-peer lending is trying to solve that by allowing for people to lend and borrow against each other. And the rates are 100% determined by the market. And so two cohorts ago in Alliance, we had a project that did this on Solana, peer-to-peer lending on Solana.
Lulo,
that's right. They're obviously very new, but one of their, I wouldn't necessarily say competitors, but a similar project that has been around longer, which is called Morpho. They've had pretty good traction so far. Like they have like $400 million in TVL. And that again is within one order of magnitude of the leader, which is Aave and Compound and the other one, all these other guys. So in lending overall, I've seen the most interesting disruptions and innovations this year.
Yeah. Just another data point highlight, 69% of loans that originated on Morpho were peer-to-peer. And so it shows you that there is a market for peer-to-peer transactions, primarily based on rates and, you know, not having to trust, you know, there are some risks involved with like pooled models versus peer-to-peer models. An example of this is Mango, which recently got hacked because of some highly illiquid assets, and they were able to take control of the pool and then deplete the pool short after. All right. So coming back to, you know, our topic of lending, and when we talked about Aave being the leading lending protocol, what I've realized about Aave is they're also incrementally innovating in the space as well with Aave V3 and Aave Go, which is its decentralized stablecoin. Aave V3 is pretty cool. What it allows you to do, since it has built so many like instances of Aave on other layers, so like layer twos and layer ones like Avalanche, it has amassed this like insane amount of TVL. So like if you compare Compound roughly, and these are like numbers that are quoted on DeFi Llama, you know, it has maybe Compound has about $1 billion, and Aave has, let's say, $4.5 billion total TVL. And that's all spread across different chains. What it's done also is it's created something called Aave Portal. And what Aave Portal does is it allows any bridge to natively connect into Aave Portal. And what it does is it natively swaps assets from different bridges on the back end. So Aave being the front end, I could instantly bridge to Arbitrum or to Avalanche natively on the back end so that I still see one UI UX, which is very interesting. And what it does is because bridges are highly illiquid, Aave extends a credit line to each bridge natively. So if you need to switch assets between different bridges and there isn't enough liquidity in the bridge, they can extend an automatic credit line to Aave, and Aave will provide the liquidity so that people can bridge in and out of different bridges. I thought that was cool because, you know, if you think about, we live in a multi-chain world, right? And if you have so many different instances of Aave on so many different protocols or layer ones and layer twos, then you're creating a very fragmented experience and you're fragmenting the liquidity on all of those different chains. But by being able to mitigate that by creating this like portal instance, then you're ultimately bridging the liquidity and the UI UX experience that you, so that users only see one UI.
And speaking of multi-chain, I think we should start talking about derivatives, because the trend I'm seeing is that derivatives are moving towards layer twos, Ethereum layer twos, or Solana. And fundamentally, it's because derivatives require much higher throughput than spot exchanges. Because the people who trade on derivative exchanges are fucking degens. They will trade like 100 times per day. So let's talk about derivatives. What are some of the data points that you're seeing or innovations that you're seeing?
Obviously, like DYDX, I don't think we need to touch much on it. You know, they're a typical club where they work with market makers that provide liquidity on different trading pairs. GMX, there's obviously a lot of buzz around GMX. GMX is a pooled derivatives model. And the way you want to think about GMX, let's talk a little bit about how they started. They started back in late 2021, and they were a merge of two communities, Gambit on Binance Chain and XVIX. And these two communities pool together and they create, and it's all, they're just a bunch of anons. We don't know who the founders are.
That's a really interesting bit of history, because I've always suspected that GMX was built by an Asian team. Just looking at the UI and the people who are associated with GMX, I've always suspected that. But now this new data point confirms that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, with Binance Chain, right?
Yep.
So, and Gambit, yeah. And the way you want to think about GMX is that they're one of the first to pioneer the pooled model, whereby users will provide liquidity to the protocol, and that liquidity is used as a way to create liquidity for the trading pairs. It's more or less like, the best way I can explain this is there's a two-token model. There's a GLP, which is the liquidity pool token, and then there's GMX staking. So GMX staking, obviously, GMX stakers get, you know, let's say 30% of the trading fees of the protocol. And GLP, which is where the liquidity is used as a way to provide liquidity for the trading pairs on GMX. So an example of this is if a trader loses, the protocol earns fees, whereby if traders win, then the GLP token holders lose. And so they are the ones that provide the liquidity for the base pairs versus market makers. So they're effectively taking the risk.
So conceptually, when I first looked at GMX, it actually reminds me of synthetics.
Yep.
Very high level, I think it's the same idea. But the key difference, I think, in the case of GMX, you can deposit any asset into this pool. Obviously, any asset within a predefined list of assets. Whereas in the case of synthetics, you can only deposit SNX, at least in the early days. Yeah. And as a result, I think there are some interesting implications of this. One is that as a liquidity provider, you no longer need to be exposed to risks of this single asset. And instead, you can deposit ETH or some independent asset, some assets that are independent to this protocol itself. And two is that you can diversify the risks by depositing a single asset into a pool of many assets. And so overall, it sounds incremental, but overall, I think it creates much better experience for liquidity providers in terms of risk diversification.
It does. There were some risks involved, right? Like, I mean, taking on the other side of a trade every time, obviously, like if you saw what happened to Alameda with the toxic order flow with FTX, mm-hmm. I mean, it could go really bad quickly mm-hmm. for people taking it on the other side.
That's why diversification is so important.
Right. Diversification is all important, but then also like they have caps on the trades. So that mitigates some of the risk of the pool of what the pools of a liquidity pool holders would incur in the long run. So by having caps in place, they're able to generate almost like $95 billion in total volume since inception. That was in August of 2021. So it kind of shows you that people really like this model.
A couple of data points I want to share is that, as I mentioned earlier, derivative platforms prefer layer twos over the mainnet. Okay, we've seen that with DYDX a long time ago. And GMX is mainly launched on Arbitrum and a little bit on Avalanche as well. Okay. So a lot of the activities on Arbitrum in the early days was actually accounted for by GMX. And the second data point I want to share is right here about synthetics, which is that synthetics actually picked Optimism. And this is not the best chart. But you can visualize the fact that the volume of Optimism has grown, relatively speaking, to Ethereum. So Optimism has grown in market share versus Ethereum for synthetics. Okay, so synthetics also prefer an L2 for the reasons that we mentioned before, which is that derivative trading requires far higher throughput. So this is a very interesting trend that I'm seeing in DeFi.
Yeah, I think... Layer twos is, I think, where we're starting to see more and more innovation. Just like people are just going to build on layer twos just based on costs, transactions, throughput, etc. And seeing synthetics like eclipse its Ethereum mainnet volume recently was also a telling fact. And maybe we can just dive into synthetics now, since we have a high level understanding of GMX. Mm-hmm. So synthetics also has sort of a pooled model, but it's not diversified. It's primarily like synthetics. I think that's changed though recently. But the way you want to think about synthetics is that they consider themselves as a permissionless perpetual protocol that will allow anyone to create assets on any derivatives. It allows them to provide liquidity on any products that are being built on top, and then being able to control the control credit based on the stakers that are staking on the platform. So they want to create this like uniformed like liquidity protocol as the way to think about it. And all the products that are being built on top are like derivatives. And so that's the promise for V3. Right now, so far, some of the cool products that they launched recently is like the Perpetuals V2, which has done almost $2.8 billion in total volume and collected almost $10 million in fees. And ultimately, the way you want to think about synthetics is similar to GMX, where they offer any derivative protocol. They've partnered with startups like Lyra, Quenta, and Polynomial that have different types of products. So Lyra is like an options AMM that settles completely on SUSD, Quenta, which is a perpetual product, and then Polynomial. But synthetics has been around for a very long time, 2018, 2017, with the launch of Haven. Mm-hmm. And they're still going, and they're continuing to innovate in the space as well.
Taking a step back and looking at the bigger picture. So earlier I said, among spot exchanges, the top decentralized spot exchanges are one order of magnitude lower than the top centralized spot exchanges. Okay. And now, if we look at the derivative exchanges, the top decentralized derivative exchanges are actually two orders of magnitude lower than the top centralized derivative exchanges, like Binance. So for example, if you combine DYDX, GMX, right, they're two orders of magnitude lower than Binance in terms of derivative volume. So there is a long way to go. And again, like I'm using data sources from like CoinGecko, Messari, like different triangulating a bunch of different data sources and come up with this two orders magnitude number, a factor of 100, basically.
Yeah. I mean, generally speaking, I think derivatives are getting harder and harder to trade on centralized platforms. And that's primarily because of regulations, right? So in the US, you really can't trade derivatives.
Yep.
If I'm a retail trader. And so these protocols like synthetics, GMX, DYDX, to a certain degree, are allowing anyone to participate. Although DYDX has kind of taken more of a regulated approach where they deny people that are in the US, they tag the wallet so that if you are a US person and you sign in, that wallet is flagged forever. You can never log into DYDX. Whereas like synthetics and GMX, they're open to the public. And so that kind of tells you about the nature.
To your point, the fact that GMX has grown so much this year is precisely for the reason that you mentioned, which is that GMX, by being anonymous, they can go full censorship resistant. As a matter of fact, they grew a lot. I remember they grew a lot when DYDX moved to require KYC. And once again, when FTX collapsed, because a lot of FTX volume is derivative trading.
Yeah. Another interesting data point I want to call out is Gains Network. This is pretty crazy, but like they're also like an Anon group. They offer derivatives for crypto assets, Forex, and synthetic equities. And it turns out most of their volume is dominated in Forex because you can't really get leverage on Forex in crypto today. Mm-hmm. And even the leverage that they offer is probably the highest that you can get in any markets today, or very competitive to those markets today. And it dominates more than 70 or 60% of the market today of G-Trade weekly volume. So that was an interesting standpoint, which is there are opportunities for protocols to build out in areas that products in areas where there isn't any offerings today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Forex is one. I think like exotics will be another area also, CFDs, et cetera, and commodities too. So
and that's Ostium.
Ostium, yeah, Team Ostium from our last batch. So I'm pretty excited about this area just because, you know, there are going to be a lot of products that are coming out that aren't really offered in crypto today that will attract new set of users.
So speaking of Forex commodities, all these non-crypto native assets, I think it's a good segue into RWA, real world assets. I've always not been a big fan of this whole theme just because it's not crypto native. But I did come across some really interesting data sets that is making me change my mind. So the first one is Maker. So Maker started adopting real world assets as part of their collateral. Okay, so people can deposit real world assets as collateral to mint DAI. And this data is actually quite impressive. So I'm just pulling that up.
What were the assets that you could deposit?
Basically, you can see it from this chart, like, you know, 6S Capital, like Monetails, HV. I don't know what they are exactly, but I think they're some kind of debt instrument from the real world. And they started doing this in August, and it's grown to $700 million as of December, as of the end of last year. I mean, still, it's a small number, but it's not nothing. Like, $700 million is significant. Like, this growth is real. So the tokenization of real world assets onto the blockchain is actually happening, surprisingly. This was one of the biggest surprises to me. And obviously that was driven by the success of Maker itself. Like, without Maker, this would not have happened. Like, it would take much longer for real world assets to get tokenized and adopted. So this is one interesting data point. The other one is Goldfinch. Goldfinch grew pretty consistently this year. The assets that are issued on Goldfinch are also debt instruments that are issued and bought by institutions. And Goldfinch has something around $100 million worth of real world assets. It's obviously much smaller than Maker, but combined, we have already almost $1 billion worth of real world assets. And that is within one order of magnitude of the top lending platforms like Aave and Compound. It's actually pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I was just thinking about MakerDAO's proposal back in July, where they got a lot of bad feedback from the community on this, but they did it anyways,
yep.
Which is they approved $500 million of MakerDAO's treasury to be diversified into like treasury bills that brings in real yield.
Yeah,
and I think that's just a function of where yield is being derived from the markets today, which is, we talked about Genesis earlier on of where the yield was coming from, a majority, right? And then if you look at, as the market chain shifted in terms of the risk, you started to see more real world assets come into the play because that's where the yield is today.
I mean, if treasury bills, treasury instruments are yielding almost 5%, why wouldn't you put some of that money into treasury bills? I understand the counter argument. The counter argument is you're going to go less crypto native. Like, you're no longer going to be censorship resistant by incorporating real world assets. So, I mean, there's argument to both sides, but both make sense to me.
Yeah, totally. It makes a lot of sense. They're creating more yield for their protocol. And overall, it's, I think, keeping the protocol robust against all the risk that's in the play right now.
Well, what's even more remarkable is that if you remember, when Maker first started, the only collateral they accepted was ETH. So ETH was 100% of the collateral.
Yeah.
But now ETH is only 20%.
That's crazy. How much is USDC?
USDC, well, stablecoins in total is about 15%.
Okay.
And guess what the remaining assets are? They're RWAs. It's pretty remarkable.
People talked about the centralized risks factor, right? Like, if, let's say, stablecoins get frozen via USDC, or the US does something about the treasury bills that it holds, whatever the counter arguments I've heard. Whatever the case may be, it hasn't happened yet. And, you know, they're generating yield for their users. And the protocol is still very robust in terms of the way it diversified its holdings. And I think that kind of talks about a testament to how I think Maker has survived for so long, is the fact that they were able to call out and diversify in certain opportunities, which kept the protocol robust compared to other assets that haven't done so well. And just talking about Goldfinch, I forgot to mention a point there, which is that, yes, they are a credit protocol, and yes, they offer lending to emerging countries and institutions, but they do this very interestingly, which is they offer like off-chain assets as collateral, right? And those off-chain assets could be in the form of, let's say, equity. So if it's like a up-and-coming like company, right, you could, the protocol itself will take in the equity, which is a real-world asset, right? And then they provide the liquidity that borrowers need. And this market has been untouched. And the reason why it's been untouched is because lenders in this area are going to charge an arm and a leg for emerging startups to borrow assets. And almost as if it was predatory. And so this is like a perfect market for someone like Goldfinch to solve, because, and we're talking like really well-known startups. We're not talking like startups that don't have credibility in the space or et cetera. We're talking like high growth, high quality startups that may have to take venture debt or have to raise more money. They can now use Goldfinch as a way to facilitate their growth.
what you just said there is really important about RWS, but something more in general is that when you do something like RWA, you can't just put any assets on chain and expect it to work. You have to identify an unsolved vertical first, a vertical that has not been solved by legacy systems. If a problem has been solved by legacy systems, like for example, if you buy real estate has been around for a while, and the systems where real estate are listed and traded, they've been around for a while. So I call them legacy systems. The problem has been solved. If you put real estate on chain, it's very unlikely to work. Empirically, that has been the case so far. Like people have tried that for years. So you have to identify a market where that has not been solved by legacy systems. So what you just mentioned about the startups assets, that seems like a vertical that has not been solved and may be solved by tokenizing it.
Although I think real estate could be solved by NFTs. That's just my...
I think eventually all the assets will be on chain.
Yeah.
But history is extremely path dependent. Like you can't do that now. Like it's going to happen eventually, but there's lower hanging fruits to solve now.
Yeah. You hear a lot about fractionalization of mortgages and tokenization of mortgages, which I think are really bad. But that's a fun topic of debate later on. And so that's like kind of the real world asset space today. The other area that, like, obviously you and I chat a lot about options and options protocols. Yep. That hasn't taken off yet, but we were quite surprised, was that Deribit still has the most open interest of all options protocols today. So looking at the data from September, they roughly have about $12 billion in total open interest, unless you have an updated number.
No, yep, that's exactly what I'm
looking at. Yeah.
And by the way, whereas a lot of data that we have is from one of the latest Delphi reports. I strongly recommend. Like I'm really impressed by the quality of their research. So
yeah. Very high quality. And if you look at like Open, Lyra, and the rest, very, very minute compared to what Deribit has. Why do you think that's the case? I have a couple ideas, but why do you think it's the case?
By the way, again, like similar to perpetual swaps and synthetics, it's the decentralized protocols are two orders of magnitude lower than the centralized counterparts. Why do I think that's the case? Well, I don't think it's because the products are bad. I think it's just because the demand isn't there yet.
Do you think it's just because retail, they just don't understand options? I mean, it's very complex compared to like YOLOing on a perpetual swap, right?
I think the fact that retail doesn't understand options is actually a positive. Because if they do, they're not going to trade options. So a lot of people try to compare the options world in crypto to options world in TradFi. So in TradFi, options volume are much, much bigger than the spot volume. So like options on single stocks is much bigger than the trading volume of single stocks themselves. And that is because of retail. Things obviously evolve over time, but definitely at the peak of the bull market where all the retail were trading options trading volume in TradFi was really, really big, was far bigger than spot volume. But why do retail in the TradFi world trade options? I think it's just because there's no futures or perpetual swaps on stocks. So options are the only instruments for them, for the retail traders to get leverage. And to make a shit ton of money off of a very small amount of investment. But in crypto, the opposite is happening. There is futures, there is perpetual swaps where retail traders can get a ton of leverage and make a ton of money with little investment. So in crypto, the biggest competitors to options, I think, is actually perpetual swaps. I think both solve the same problem, which is leverage. Yeah. I think that's why demand for options may not be there yet today.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very interesting point. And you could see this in some of the product innovations too. If you look at like Open as an example, they've built something called Squeeth. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Okay. Squeeth, you could think of this, it's called like Squared ETH. And essentially it's a ERC-20 token that gives you perpetual option exposure. And the way you want to think about this is, it tracks the index of ETH and it provides pure convexity and gamma exposure without the need for strikes and expiry. So you hold this asset and over time, if you're long ETH, then over time, it will give you leverage and it will compound over time. So let's say you have, you buy the asset and you're at like 0.5x leverage. And if ETH goes up, let's say, you know, 5x, you get like 2.5x leverage is the way to think about it. And there's no downside. There's protected downside exposure and there's no risk of liquidation is the way to think about it. So I feel like they designed this as a way to bring on more retail users, as a way to get options exposure without having to actually deal with the options UI UX as an example. But if you short squeeze, then you could be liquidated and but you get paid funding rate. So that's how squeeze works in its form. And it's done okay. It's done like, it has like 89 million in total interest. I've used squeeze personally. And so it's a fun, it's a cool product to toy around with, but yeah.
And options are a good segue into structured products because the structured products are basically based on the options. So if you think about the financial stack, you have options and a layer above is the structured products based on options and other potentially sophisticated instruments. So unsurprisingly, Ribbon, which is part of Alliance, Ribbon was the first structured project that we came across. So I believe they're actually the first mover. And unsurprisingly, Ribbon is still number one in the space. Obviously, if you look at this chart, overall volume goes down for all the reasons we've mentioned before. That's not unique to structured products, but common to DeFi in general. But Ribbon is still number one. So this chart does not include all the structured products out there. There's really a saturation of structured products projects at the moment. And it's just so hard for them to differentiate from each other. That's why, that's partly why Ribbon, obviously they've executed really well. But the fact that they are the first mover is part of the reasons why they're still the leader today.
I mean, it just goes back to, you know, retail, right? Which is structured products are probably the best way to allow retail to gain exposure to these automated strategies in a way that provides yield. And that's all they need to worry
retail
about.
Retail wants yield. One of the central theses of DeFi.
Yeah.
And part of the reason why DeFi yield has gone down or DeFi volume has gone down is because of the competition from the US Treasury, which is currently yielding at almost 5%. In terms of risk reward, there's actually very few assets around the world that are better than US Treasury right now.
That's right. Maybe the final two areas that I'd love to touch on outside of like structured products is under collateralized lending, Maple. And, you know, high level decentralized credit protocol whereby, you know, stakers earn yield. There's a pool and there's a delegate that manages and underwrites risk. And they can provide liquidity to those that ask for the borrow. So let's say, and they're typically to like well-known institutions like Wintermute and et cetera. Recently, they got hit because Orthogonal Capital didn't pay back the loan. And so there is some like risk factors behind using these types of protocols. But I also think it's an interesting segue into like thinking about capital efficiency, right? Because we always talk about in DeFi, where is capital efficiency? You hear about like credit being one aspect of it. But I think this is also an interesting element in regards to being able to provide capital efficient loans to institutions in the space.
So there has been a growing narrative post FTX that, you know, people think that under collateralized lending or capital efficient lending is not going to be a thing. DeFi actually outperformed CeFi precisely because DeFi is mostly over collateralized, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, under collateralized lending will happen.
Yep.
It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And I've personally underestimated how hard it is to build under collateralized lending. So it's taking longer than I originally expected, but it will happen. It's not a good idea to hate on under-collateralized lending. What really happened with the likes of Genesis, by the way, is under-collateralized lending, for example. Yeah. What really happened to under-collateralized lending, whether it's in DeFi or CeFi, is the mispricing of risks. It's not the fact that it's under-collateralized, it's because the risks are mispriced. The rates were too low to compensate for the risks that the lenders we're taking, and the risks will be taken care of by the market. The market will always take care of itself in terms of rates, risks.
Yeah.
So we're just going to see higher yields, higher rates, but that does not prevent under-collateralized lending from happening?
So I think from all of what we've seen so far in DeFi, we, one, learned more about the state of DeFi today, and then more or less kind of dove deep into some of the areas that we're most excited about. Pausing here, thinking about the future, where do you think this is all going to go?
I think DeFi 1.0 is still the most important thing in DeFi.
Yeah.
Not the 2.0 or 3.0 or whatever that happened afterwards. The DeFi 1.0 was basically stablecoins, lending, DEXs. We mentioned this before. These are the core pieces of the financial stack. They're lower in the stack. I think we talked about this before, but we like things that are lower on the stack, not the stuff that's higher on the stack. And what happened over the last year was a lot of things higher on the stack happened, but they've mostly been incremental. DeFi 1.0 is still interesting. There's going to be interesting development. So with fixed rate lending, with peer-to-peer lending, with whatever order book or new AMMs that the incumbents will come out with. But the other area, which we haven't really talked about, but I would argue it's also part of DeFi, is MEV. MEV is actually going to see quite interesting things in the next couple of years. I think right now MEV has the highest mind share in terms of like among the Giga Brains. I don't know if you want to talk about it or should we talk about, should we reserve this discussion for a whole episode because it's such a complex topic.
Yeah, I think we should definitely leave it for next episode. But I agree with you, MEV is going to be the battle for control of order flow is a very interesting topic.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's going to be, you know, something like Flashbots and Suave or wallets being able to control the RPC nodes where they can direct the order flow. I think that's going to be a very interesting topic on its own.
Yeah. So maybe just a quick preview for the MEV stuff. So obviously Flashbots announced Suave. And from my understanding, it's trying to solve two problems. One is the cross-chain MEV. So before Suave, basically all the MEV solutions out there focus on single chain MEV, right? So people can, for example, arbitrage within the same chain. But obviously there's arbitrage opportunities across chains. So that's one of the key problems that they're solving. The other problem that they're solving is if you think about the supply chain of MEV, right? From wallet, from users to wallet, to searchers, to builders, to proposers, this whole supply chain. Up until now, most of the battles or most of the trading marketplace happens at the builder slash proposer part of the cycle. But a very interesting trend recently is that there's a lot of searchers that want to buy order flow directly from the users in private deals. So that happens at the beginning of the supply chain between the users and the searchers. And that's a very strong force of centralization. And Flashbots want to disrupt that by turning this part from a centralized phenomenon into a decentralized marketplace in a similar way that they turned the later part of the supply chain 2 years ago from a centralization into a marketplace.
Without diving too deep into next episode, whoever owns the end customer could ultimately even own the order flow. And we'll talk about this later.
And that's the super wallet thesis.
And the super wallet thesis. So we'll talk about this in the next episode without revealing too much of what we're thinking about. What do I think about DeFi and the future? Well, I'd say 80% of the innovation DeFi is done. We're going through incremental growth that can double down on security and capital efficiency. And we will start to see, at least to me, cannibalization of competitors. So what do I mean by that? Well, Aave releasing its own decentralized stablecoin, Curve releasing its own stablecoin, Ribbon launching Ribbon Earn or Lend to start to compete in the lending space. We're going to start to see more or less protocols start to take on other sectors of DeFi. And I think this is going to over time turn into the DeFi bundling thesis, which is the fact that like DeFi could become bundled because many of these products standalone will not work. But if you have a very strong liquidity sink, right, such as like Aave and Compound and others, they can start to build out other products horizontally into other DeFi sectors. And so I do think that we're going to start to see more or less like, you know, capital efficiency from that. You're going to see credit being expanded. So I think that we're going to go through like some sort of like bundling period. And then after that, I think focus on consumer and being able to build some sort of single easy way for consumers to get a yield to these types of products.
Just to add to what you said about where this is going, for me, the biggest tailwind this year or last year was FTX. And as I mentioned before, the volume has not really changed so far. So the tailwind seems to be taking a long time to play out. But we know from the public statements of some of the regulators, some of the TradFi people, that they finally get DeFi now. They understand it now. They get why this thing is important. And that is to provide transparency into the risks into the system. Obviously, DeFi has other benefits, such as for many users, it's actually better user experience in terms of withdrawing, deposit, and all that stuff, like being able to use multiple platforms from one wallet. For me personally, that's a huge benefit. But for the TradFi people, the average Joe, the regulators, the transparency and the auditability is the most important value proposition for them.
Agreed. Well, great episode. I really enjoyed this conversation. One, because DeFi has been very close to me. I use it day to day. Hopefully this gives some insight to what's happening in the DeFi world. We remain bullish, even with the incremental growth that we're seeing, because obviously now we're in the growth phase of DeFi and the goal is to start to get more and more users. And yeah, that's all it from my side. Any final words, Chao?
I guess my advice for founders is not to be so obsessed about the math, the algorithm. Building a product is so much more holistic than improving whatever AMM model or liquidation engine. It's far more holistic. It involves, for example, the front end, like making things easier, lower friction for users. Growth hacking, how do you grow users? Like the centralized exchanges are so good at that by using stuff like referrals, referral programs. I think DeFi founders somehow lack a little bit of this more holistic thing. You can never pinpoint one thing to say this was the thing that led to the success of this protocol or project. It's always a number of things. So that would be my advice for founders is to look at things more holistically.
We also have alliance.xyz/ideas. And there are a lot of great requests for startup proposals that is on that doc. So take a look to see if you're looking to build in DeFi and you're looking for new areas to build into, definitely a document that you should use as a resource moving forward. Otherwise, Chao, thanks. Looking forward to seeing you guys next episode when we talk about MEV. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Good Game. Don't forget to subscribe. We'll see you next week.